Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. We want to quickly open a work session on Senate Bill 753.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 753 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 753 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I would just like to thank the department for their cooperation and for making a zero fiscal on it.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Excuse.
Aye. Oh. He's right here next to me.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excuse.
Okay, there you go.
Senator Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Knope will carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 753 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 490. And we only have 40 minutes for the bill, so 20 minutes for the proponents and 20 minutes for the opponents. So with that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 490, and Laura Terrell Patton, Kate Ruff, and Carrie Snodgrass.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senate members of the committee. My name is Laura Terrell Patton, and I'm the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 490. This bill addresses critical patient safety concerns that occur as a result of the way many crisis pregnancy centers operate. I'm here today to ask the committee to create minimum disclosure and transparency expectations for crisis pregnancy centers operating in Oregon. In 2007, the Crisis Pregnancy Center Review Act was introduced with the hope of learning more about what happens at these centers in our state. If passed, the Department of Human Services would have been charged with collecting data from crisis pregnancy centers on the accuracy of medical information provided, advertising methods used, and the types of services provided. Unfortunately, the bill did not pass and the study was never conducted. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon continued to hear stories from young women who had bad experiences at crisis pregnancy centers, so we conducted our own research starting in April 2010. We have two of our longtime supporters with us today, Kate and Carrie, who will speak to their experiences regarding these centers. We uncovered information that caused us grave concern, especially with regard to the deceptive practices used in advertising the type of information provided once a woman enters the facility. We were able to identify more than 45 crisis pregnancy centers operating in Oregon. These facilities are mostly unregistered with the Oregon Corporations Divisions and have no restrictions with regard to how they operate. There's a wide range of services offered, but most are staffed by volunteers with the goal of convincing women with unintended pregnancies not to have an abortion. But crisis pregnancy centers present themselves as something different, seeking to attract young and economically vulnerable women in crisis. Many of these facilities disguise themselves as medical clinics. On the surface, it is hard to tell the difference between a crisis pregnancy center and an actual medical facility. These centers create the appearance of a medical office with their advertising and signage, but use waiting rooms, intake forms, and white lab coats. But crisis pregnancy centers are not medical facilities, and they are not required to adhere to medical privacy laws established to protect patient privacy and confidentiality of records. Women entering CPCs are often unknowingly giving up their medical privacy rights because they believe they're in a legitimate medical facility where their information will be kept confidential as required by HIPAA. Deceptive signs and center names mislead women facing unintended pregnancies into thinking they will receive comprehensive services and accurate medical information. Despite claims of providing quote-unquote all options, these centers do not provide comprehensive information as they refuse to give referrals for access to abortion or contraception, focusing only on adoption and abstinences and making unsubstantiated claims that abortion leads to breast cancer and infertility. We were deeply concerned to learn that the majority of the centers we visited provided medically inaccurate information designed to discourage use of birth control pills and condoms, which have potentially negative impact on public health and can have life-threatening consequences. Senate Bill 490 addresses concerns about lack of transparency at facilities that provide pregnancy tests and sonograms to be transparent about what services they do and do not provide. The bill mandates clarity in advertising and in easily visible signs on the premises whether the facility provides comprehensive birth control services, access to licensed medical provider, and referral or access to abortion and prenatal medical care. Our concern about privacy is addressed through a requirement in the bill that the client records and medical information must be kept private and confidential unless written consent of the consumer has been granted. Senate Bill 490 also requires crisis pregnancy centers to make client records, including written results of any tests or imaging, available to the client at no cost. The bill exempts doctor's offices and bona fide medical clinics that currently have much stricter guidelines governing their practices through state legislation and their board of licensure. Senate Bill 490 establishes a complaint process through the Oregon Health Authority, which has oversight and is charged with investigating complaints. The bill creates penalties for those facilities who do not comply and a fine structure that begins with a written warning and graduates up to a maximum of $10,000 for violations that are not resolved over time. We believe this bill has a neutral impact on the budget because the fines go to the Oregon Health Authority to fund the investigative and administrative work. Senate Bill 490 has widespread support throughout the state. We have collected petition signatures from more than 13,000 Oregonians who want crisis pregnancy centers to stop jeopardizing women's health. And these voices are coming from everywhere, from Vernonia to Pendleton to Almsville to Lapine to Wolf Creek and Brookings. And we've submitted a sample of those letters to the committee in advance. I urge this committee to address these patient privacy concerns and establish minimum consumer protection standards for crisis pregnancies in Oregon by supporting Senate Bill 490. Thank you.
Let's go through the panel first.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Kate Ruff, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today in support of Senate Bill 490. I have been a volunteer for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon for almost 5 years now. I'm also a full-time student at Portland State University pursuing my Master's of Social Work, and I also work full-time. I'm here today to speak as a participant in a research project that Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon conducted starting in April of 2010. I volunteered to help research information and services that crisis pregnancy centers provide in Oregon. In 2010, Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon identified 52 crisis pregnancy centers operating within our state. A total of 19 volunteers, myself included, participated in this project. We researched 43 crisis pregnancy centers, 23 in person and 20 by phone. I personally conducted in-person visits to 8 crisis pregnancy centers where I presented myself as being concerned I might be facing an unintended pregnancy. During my visits, I observed a variety of factors, including what types of services were offered, how the center described itself, and the hours of operation. I also took note of procedural methods, paperwork, and materials I received during my visits. I did not use any audio or video recording devices during my visits, but I did document my findings on a standard written form immediately following each visit to allow for the most accurate recollection of details. From the visits, we learned that crisis pregnancy centers offer free urine-based pregnancy tests and that some provide other services such as baby supplies, parenting classes, and maternity clothes. Some crisis pregnancy centers also advertise more extensive services such as testing for sexually transmitted infections, although it is unclear whether these services are provided routinely by a licensed medical providers or whether referrals for these services are available if the entity is unable to provide the advertised service. What my fellow researchers and I observed raised serious concerns about patient safety and consumer protection. None of the crisis pregnancy centers we contacted during the research offered medical exams, birth control, prenatal care, or childbirth services. But walking into one of these centers, it would be easy to mistake it for a doctor's office where actual medical services are provided. The people you meet often carry clipboards, act like medical staff, and sometimes even wear white lab coats. The crisis pregnancy centers I visited went out of their way to seem like you were a patient in a doctor's office, with waiting rooms and intake forms. At one center, I was asked for my photo ID. I didn't feel comfortable handing it over because these centers do not have to adhere to medical privacy laws established to protect patient privacy, so I told the crisis pregnancy center volunteers that I left it at home. One of the volunteers then said that they would have to take my photo and store it on file to serve as identification if I ever came back to request my medical records. This choice of words seemed wrong to me since this was not a medical clinic. While many of the crisis pregnancy centers look like real medical facilities, very few disclosed that they were not medical clinics and had limited services available. In Salem, it wasn't until after I received my pregnancy test results and asked for birth control that I was told the crisis pregnancy center was not a clinic. Women visiting crisis pregnancy centers are often looking for accurate health information that will allow them to make informed decisions regarding their health. Instead, they're given medically inaccurate and potentially dangerous information when they are most vulnerable and frightened. While visiting the crisis pregnancy centers, I received an array of information on abortion and birth control. I was told that abortion leads to breast cancer and can cause post-traumatic stress disorder. These statements were accompanied by dozens of brochures with medically inaccurate information. Some examples of the brochures are attached to the written testimony I submitted today. One center tried to intimidate me from considering abortion by showing me a photo of a pregnant woman undergoing surgery, and from the incision in her stomach, a fetus's hand could be seen sticking out and making a small fist. Crisis pregnancy centers are also giving women medically inaccurate information about birth control that discourages them from using safe and effective methods. I received one brochure entitled Birth Control, Homicidal Deception that contained an excerpt that read, "The pill and its cousins kill children earlier in life than surgical abortion, so they cause many more deaths than surgical abortion. This is completely inaccurate since birth control pills keep a woman from ovulating and thereby make fertilization impossible. Other brochures discourage using condoms, even saying that using a condom endangers your life. In reality, by providing medically inaccurate information, crisis pregnancy centers are endangering women. Thank you for your time and consideration on this important legislation."
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today in support of SB 490. I am an intern for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, and I am here today to speak as our participant.
Please say your name for the record.
It's Carrie Snodgrass. I'm here today to speak as a participant in a research project that Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon conducted in March of 2013 involving crisis pregnancy centers in Oregon. The goal of the research project was to determine which crisis pregnancy centers were operating in Oregon and which ones claimed or alluded to being a medical clinic. What I learned varied from entity to entity. Several of the crisis pregnancy centers told me they were medical clinics, while some admitted they were not. As you have already heard, crisis pregnancy centers are generally not staffed with licensed personnel and therefore not required to follow accepted medical protocols nor adhere to basic consumer protection standards. Most of the crisis pregnancy centers said that I would have to wait up to 1 hour for my pregnancy results. As is widely known, urine-based pregnancy tests only take a few minutes to process. So by delaying my test results, the crisis pregnancy center could fill the time with biased counseling intended to mislead me about my possible options. I told one crisis pregnancy center located in Gresham that if I turned out to be pregnant, I was terrified how my boyfriend would react. Upon learning that I was facing a potentially violent situation at home, the operator responded by placing me on hold so she could answer another call. There are also crisis pregnancy centers, like one in Lebanon, that displays signs with the words health clinic, which adds to the confusion. This is a serious problem because women believe they are visiting a real medical clinic where there is a commonly understood expectation that they will receive confidential medical services. But when a woman walks into a crisis pregnancy center, she's checking her medical privacy rights at the door without even knowing it. In closing, I ask this committee to support SB 490 and require crisis pregnancy centers to be transparent about their purpose and services. Young women like me visit these centers looking for help and accurate information, and we shouldn't have to put our safety and privacy at risk to get the help we need. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
You. Dr. Lace, Ann Bailey, Barry Lieber, and Michelle Stranger. Hunter.
Want me to go first? Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon, and I also am the chair of the OMA Legislative Committee. We support Senate Bill 490. I don't have to reiterate all the previous points that were brought up, but suffice to say, you know, when I am in my office, when I'm in the hospital, I wear a name tag. They know who I am. When they come in to see me in the office, they have to sign release of information forms for HIPAA. We protect their confidentiality. We take that very seriously. There's no misrepresentation. When they're in my clinic, they know who I am because we've got these name tags. Everybody wears these. So we would expect that anybody that offers themselves as a medical service or at least even looks like a medical service would have that same protection, and the patients are informed about what their rights are, and that when they come in to see somebody, you know, for counseling, for any advice, that that's all very open and very transparent. And I don't have to repeat all the other points, but that's short and sweet.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Healthcare Committee. Thank you for allowing us to testify in support of Senate Bill 490. My name is Ann Barry Lever, and I'm testifying on behalf of Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. I'm addressing the committee as a primary care provider with over 20 years of service to my patients, and I would like to share some of my experiences as a nurse practitioner. My focus today is to advocate for patients to understand what pregnancy services they are receiving, and I practiced for 18 years in the college setting, providing primary preventative care to students, GYN care, and pregnancy counseling. This bill is a common sense step to offer clear information and protect the privacy of women like my patients during what I consider is one of the most vulnerable times of their life. Over my years in practice, I've seen a number of students who have come to me after their experiences at crisis pregnancy centers, and these experiences have been confusing for patients. Many other points, like Dr. Lace, there are many that were already made, so I'm going to skip over some. The centers are not required to refer patients to other providers for services that they don't offer, like prenatal care or domestic violence resources. And this has led to very risky, dangerous situations. The unregulated process for the patient breeds further crisis, adverse outcomes, and elevated health risks for young people like my patients confronting unintended pregnancies. Some of the statements I've heard after they've been to a pregnancy crisis center is, how do I get to see a doctor? I felt ashamed and judged about my options. I know the information I was given is not accurate. That's why I've come to see you. And these experiences, I think, are deeply troubling. According to Contraceptology Today, one out of every two women have an unintended pregnancy in their lifetime. And when assessing unintentional pregnancy, it is a crisis. And patients are often young, vulnerable, and they lack coping skills and support systems. So in view of this, I support Senate Bill and encourage you to vote yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Michelle Stranger Hunter. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon and the Oregon Foundation for Reproductive Health. We are in strong support of Senate Bill 490. We are very concerned about the vulnerable women who seek services at a very high-stress time of fearing they're pregnant or thinking they're pregnant or having taken a pregnancy test. This is when they need healthcare professionals. I am a strong advocate of comprehensive reproductive health care, and I'm concerned that misleading information provided by crisis pregnancy centers is jeopardizing both patient safety and public health. There's a huge difference between the services provided by a crisis pregnancy counseling center and a comprehensive women's medical clinic. Oregon women, especially vulnerable women facing an unplanned pregnancy, need to know whether they are entering a comprehensive women's medical clinic that will provide them with medically accurate, evidence-based information, or if they are entering a crisis pregnancy center that may look like a medical clinic but won't provide a comprehensive range of services. So, for example, if a woman is pregnant, if she goes to a comprehensive women's medical clinic, she will get a referral for prenatal care, adoption services, or abortion services, depending upon what she needs. They are all provided in a non-directive and non-judgmental environment. If a woman is not pregnant, she's offered contraception, family planning services, STD screening, clinical breast exams, life-saving cancer screenings. If she's suspected to be a victim of domestic abuse, then someone is there to give a referral for support and licensed medical staff who meet mandatory reporting laws. These comprehensive women's medical clinics also follow HIPAA, medical privacy laws, to ensure the personal records are kept confidential. None of these aspects are in place in crisis pregnancy counseling centers. I urge you to support Senate Bill 490, and I really thank the chair, Monis Anderson, and the committee for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call up Beverly Anderson, Claire Cook, and Jennifer Randolph.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify today. My name is Beverly Anderson. I'm an active member of the Oregon State Bar. I engaged in the private practice for law for more than a decade, and I am currently the executive director of Lane Pregnancy Support Center in Eugene. Lane Pregnancy was formed in 1989 as a crisis pregnancy hotline and has been serving our community in Lane County ever since. We're a faith-based organization and are funded entirely by private donations from over 3,200 supporters. All of our services are offered free of charge to our patients. I speak today in opposition to Senate Bill 490. This bill is nearly identical to the Senate Bill 769, which was introduced in 2011. Very minor changes to the language have been made, but even with those changes, it's still bad legislation. Once again, proponents of the bill target only entities that oppose abortion. The bill would apply to an entity if its primary purpose is to provide pregnancy-related services, such as prenatal sonography, pregnancy tests, or pregnancy options counseling. Pro-life pregnancy centers are the principal, if not the only, existing entities that fit that definition. My review of the bill leads me to conclude that it is a deceptive solution in search of an undocumented problem. Senate Bill 490 is the Oregon version of model legislation being pushed by abortion activists as part of a coordinated national effort by well-funded and often taxpayer-funded organizations who seek to silence faith-based charitable entities who disagree with them while avoiding regulation themselves. Similar measures have been introduced and defeated in multiple states. City and county versions have been challenged on constitutional grounds, overturned by federal judges, and are still being litigated. There are two ordinances currently, one in New York and one in Baltimore, which also require pregnancy centers to post notices that they do not provide or make referrals for abortion, emergency contraception, or birth control services. I'd like to read from you what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals had to say about those ordinances. They affirmed the district court holding that disclaimers required by the Baltimore ordinance is a form of compelled speech that alters the course of a pregnancy center's communication with a client or prospective client. That speech is about abortion and birth control and is based at least in part on disagreement with the viewpoint of the pregnancy center. The court noted particularly that ordinances targeting pro-life centers and thus regulating communication that are personal, moral, political, and religious. By requiring a disclaimer that the pregnancy center does not provide or refer for abortions, the ordinance compels the plaintiffs to deliver the implied message that these services are available elsewhere and should be considered. Thus appearing to legitimize such services in violation of the plaintiff's beliefs. That court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, held that that was unconstitutional compelled speech, the very regulation that you're being asked to pass. The New York Federal District Court wrote, at the heart of the First Amendment lies the principle that each person should decide for himself or herself the ideas and beliefs deserving of expression, consideration, and adherence. Government action that stifles speech on account of its message or that requires the utterance of a particular message favored by the government contravenes the essential First Amendment principle. Laws of this sort pose the inherent risk that the government seeks not to advance a legitimate regulatory goal, but to suppress unpopular ideas or information or manipulate the public debate through coercion rather than persuasion. And this is what the court wrote. This is particularly true where, as here, plaintiff's speech on reproductive rights concerns an issue prevalent in public discourse. The court went on to say that the law will alter the tenor of the pregnancy center's advertising by drowning their intended message in the city's preferred admonitions. The requirement that certain disclosures be made will significantly alter the manner in which the pregnancy center approach those topics with their audience, mandating that they affirmatively espouse the government's position on a contested public issue where the differences of opinion are both real and substantive. Senate Bill 490 also would violate equal protection rights of pro-life pregnancy centers by failing to regulate similar organizations with differing ideologies, such as abortion clinics or family planning organizations. Vague and ambiguous language in the bill is problematic and raises due process concerns. But on a more practical level, Senate Bill 490 does not address an actual harm. I provided a sample of our request for services form that each of our patients completes, and I provided those to Ashley. You will notice that in the middle of the back page, each woman initials that she knows that we do not refer or for or perform abortions. This is our intake form and is completed by every patient before we provide any services. This is standard practice for pregnancy centers in Oregon. Proponents of Senate Bill 490 claim that pregnancy centers endanger women's health by deceptive coercion and or delaying the decision to seek an abortion, yet these proponents refer patients to our services. You'll notice on the front of the request for service form at the bottom of the page, we ask our patient how they heard about us. This patient, the sample that I've given you that's been redacted to protect her privacy, this patient, like many others, was referred by Planned Parenthood. We routinely have referrals from Planned Parenthood. Let me tell you about two patients who recently have visited Lane Pregnancy Support Center. One came to us after visiting Planned Parenthood. She had a positive pregnancy test and was offered an abortion on the spot. She told us that she felt a little bewildered and was unready to make a decision, so she came to talk to us. We ran a pregnancy test which showed that she was not, in fact, pregnant. She did not have a pregnancy-related decision to make. Where was the harm to that patient's health? Another patient came to us to have an ultrasound so she would know her exact gestational age. She told us she needed the information to know exactly what type of an abortion to have. She came back several weeks later because she had not started her period again after her abortion as she expected to. Our nurse, our registered nurse, was able to provide medical information, a referral to a doctor, valuable follow-up services that weren't given her elsewhere. Again, I ask, where's the danger to this woman's health? These two stories are only very brief examples of the patients we see and the services we provide. 99% of our patients say that they would refer a friend or family member to us. Comments on our exit surveys regularly say things like, and I'm quoting directly from what patients write, they were understanding of my critical time frame without judging me and my situation. I got all of my questions and concerns answered clearly, thank you. I always feel comfortable in that my information is kept private and respected. I enjoyed my visit. I was calming and I didn't feel judged. In short, Senate Bill 490 is an ill-conceived measure which, if passed, would subject the state of Oregon to expensive legal challenges, which established law indicates the state cannot win. The only compelling interest behind this bill is Planned Parenthood's desire to stop pregnancy centers from voicing an opinion different from their own. Please do not be enticed by the proponents of Senate Bill 490 into passing a law which is designed to limit women's choices by encumbering pregnancy centers. We provide valuable services to our communities at no taxpayer expense. We are not motivated by profits. Don't allow those who disagree with our opinion to put Oregon in the position of enforcing or defending their private agenda. Thank you for your careful consideration of these issues.
Senator Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Claire King. As medical director at Salem's Pregnancy Medical Clinic, I'd like to spotlight how this bill's passage would actually impact the very practice of medicine. I have been a family practice doc for nearly 24 years and can therefore experientially confirm that medicine is indeed an art. That art hangs very heavily on knowing the exquisite timing of when to speak and when not to speak. In my regular family practice, I do not post signs on the waiting room wall. I mean, imagine a sign that says, smoker, you can count on a lengthy talking to, or overweight, try good old-fashioned willpower. Or how about pregnant, no abortion here. Of course, this ridiculously exaggerates, but my point is that a sign has no ability to explain itself. And because of this very fact, a sign has a potential to speak volumes in the opposite wrong direction. Signs like that destroy my agenda even before I get to make eye contact with a patient. And my agenda is to heal and to soothe, not to alienate. Signs like that drain me completely of any power that I might have had to delve into the wonderfully complicated personhood of my patient and to lay a groundwork of non-judgment and trust that allows me to gently unearth and extract the strengths and weaknesses of my patient and to thereby ultimately guide my patient through the process of wrapping their arms around the full extent of the problem and grappling with the solutions that accommodate it. All that could potentially not happen because of a misconstrued sign hanging on my waiting room wall. If I want to motivate a patient towards health and wholeness, I must first build a rapport, one which allows me to communicate at a heart level and thereby convey at that same level messages more like, I'm for you. I'm not against you. I understand. I'm human too. Let me help. I will not abandon you. We will walk this together. Unfortunately, there aren't any believable placards out there that can convince a patient of that kind of sincerity and truth. The convincing comes from the rapport that has been first laid to a groundwork of trust. I wish that there were such magical signs. I really do. It would make my job easier. I'd be way more efficient. I'd see many more patients in the day. My husband would see me more because I leave earlier. But alas, I have yet to find just such a wall sign that does this trick. Instead, these signs and notifications, such as Bill 490 would mandate, seem to accomplish just exactly the opposite of what they set out to do. Rather than spearhead patient care, they invariably shut an inflexible door of steel on communication altogether, with somewhat of a dismissive air of judgment and finality. I mean, there is no room for explanation. There's no exception for an individual case basis. There it is on the wall. We don't do this, period. End of statement. So, personally, I avoid signs on my waiting room walls, and I avoid stickers on my car bumper, and I avoid buttons on my lapel. But I do believe in this. because I will always opt to paint my views with all the verbal and nonverbal brushes at my disposal. The color and texture of this rendition far more accurately portrays what I want to communicate than a black and white perfunctory written announcement that somehow is just way too lacking. Just as simply reading a transcript from today's hearing will miss something of the passion of those of us who are for and against Bill 490. I could go on to emphasize other noteworthy facts, such as just how much pregnancy centers exceed all state and local standards, guidelines, medical requirements, how there is an intricate system of checks and balances, as well as professional oversight to ensure medical excellence and accuracy within each and every clinic, how patient confidentiality is always paramount, how healthcare providers like me should not be hindered in volunteering their services by vague language that mandates employment. These are all important points, but I do not want to risk softening my true emphasis on just how greatly freedom of expression, and even more so, freedom of non-expression, impacts the art of my profession, and how even a seemingly innocuous sign that on the surface serves only to innocently inform, hanging there on the waiting room wall, how that can in fact insidiously ambush my work before it has even begun. Please, therefore, see this bill for what it truly is. It's a restriction. It's a hindrance. It is not a help to excellent patient care. So on that final note, if you want to see truly excellent patient care in action, please, any one of you, take me up on a sincere offer to come visit, tour your very own Salem's Hope Pregnancy Clinic. I might add that just this past month, our clinic received the highly coveted accreditation from the AAAHC. This stands for Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare. It is an institution which sets the national benchmark for the highest standards in quality ambulatory healthcare and patient safety. My praise of the clinic hardly does it justice. Therefore, an actual visit is worth 1,000 of my words. And actually, I'm kind of surprised to hear reports from the proponent side because that doesn't sound like my clinic at all. Again, any of you senators, proponents of Bill 490, anyone, you are always more than welcome to come visit. Thank you so much for this hearing.
And we have about 5 minutes left, and we have four speakers left for the opponents.
Chairperson, excuse me, Senator Moans Anderson and senators of the committee, my name is Jennifer Randolph. I am testifying in opposition to SB 490 because it threatens to place unwarranted regulations upon pregnancy resource centers that provide essential assistance and resources to women like me in our Oregon communities. My personal story reflects thousands of others in situations like mine. The first time I benefited from PRC, I woke up after sleeping the night away in my car with my boyfriend. Even though I was strung out on meth, it had been days since I had gotten that much sleep, and I was able to focus for a moment. I realized I had a bump on my stomach and knew I better go get tested. After being told that PRC would give me a free pregnancy test, I went there and was told by the professional staff at PRC that I had a baby growing in me. My boyfriend and I talked about not being able to keep it right at that visit. The PRC counselor was compassionate, and I could tell she had hoped that we would keep it, although in her professionalism, she never stated her opinion. I told her I needed to talk to my parents and think about it, and she said she was there for me if I needed to talk. We left that appointment and went straight to my parents' house. I had not visited them for months as they did not condone my drug abuse. Right as I pulled into the driveway, my mom came running out and said that the police were looking for me for one of the crimes I had committed. Overwhelmed, I blurted out that I was pregnant. We went inside the house where my dad met us and I told him I was pregnant. He reassured me that I was going to be okay and I could do this. I wish I could say that that was the end of my drug abuse, but it was not. I found out I was 5.5 months along. I eventually needed some pregnancy clothes, which PRC was kind enough to help me out with. They also had educational videos for me to watch and to learn how my baby was developing and what to do once my baby arrived, because I had never even changed a diaper before. Sadly, I kept using drugs until just a few weeks of giving birth. On August 18, 1996, I gave birth to a baby boy. I named him Torin. My sobriety only lasted 2 weeks after giving birth. My parents said I could leave Torin with them while I went out. Shortly after my absence, I was put in jail for drugs. I tested positive again for a pregnancy and was told that I needed to have an abortion because I could not even take care of my first child. I went to a clinic and had my procedure. I was not even given any counseling or follow-up care after that. And from then on, I used drugs heavily. I'm not downing the clinic. The only point I wish to make was that I was not given the counseling or education that I have been given at Pregnancy Resource Center. I entered into treatment when my son, Torin, was 3 years old. I realized that I had hit my bottom and knew I had nothing. I can't explain it other than to say that my desire to use drugs was removed completely. My clean date now is 12/16 of 1999. I didn't have the obsession any longer. I was indeed set free. 7 years into my recovery, I went on my first date with my soon-to-be husband. 8 months later, we were married. He had custody of his 3 sons and was also in recovery. Together, that made 4 sons. Soon into our marriage, we made the decision to have a child, and I got pregnant. It was nice to have a planned pregnancy, and I had my test done at PRC. It was such a blessing to have the services they offered because the education of the staff associated with PRC really showed with the many questions I asked. I took my 4 sons with me up to the center on a weekly visit to watch all the movies they could on how the baby develops and what to expect once the baby is here. I was able to receive clothes for my newborn. I had also had an ultrasound done there with my husband and sons. The PRC staff was always very welcoming and generous. Victor, who I named after my dad, is 4 years old. My dad always believed in me no matter what. After Victor was born, something more was tugging at my heart that I needed to find healing from the abortion I had. Again, I sought help through PRC, and I knew they were connected with a program called HEART. It was a study that took me through the healing process of the guilt I felt over having an abortion. I was able to forgive myself because of the education PRC provided. My husband and I decided we wanted one more child. It didn't take long for me to confirm the good news that we were pregnant through PRC. At around 12 weeks, I had a doctor's visit where they were concerned about the baby's head being a little big. I knew the only thing I cared about was if it had a heartbeat. You see, regardless of how a baby looks, it is still a baby from day one of conception. When I was 16 weeks pregnant, which was back in October, I went to a routine ultrasound appointment and found out that my baby had passed. Since the baby was developed as much as it had, I was offered 2 choices, a DNC or delivery. I chose deliver. I delivered my beautiful baby girl at 16 weeks. All of her toes and fingers were there. I was so excited to know that my husband could make a baby girl. We named her Marjorie Mary. Even after we lost Marjorie, I was able to reach out to PRC and get support. It is amazing that PRC has been such an important part of my pregnancies. Whether I was processing my feelings of my abortion, had an unplanned pregnancy that resulted in birth, or had a planned pregnancy that ended in miscarriage, or had a planned pregnancy that gave me a beautiful baby boy, PRC has been there to educate and support me. In closing, I look back at my 16-year-old son, Torin. What if I had aborted him? Because I had PRC turned to for counseling, I was able to make the decision that was right for me. Without PRC, Torin wouldn't be here today. Torin is a fine young man who I am honored to call my son. Torin, please stand up. I could have aborted him, and I didn't. My husband and I have a practice called Compassionate Interventions. We help families by educating them how to properly deal with loved ones struggling with addiction and helping them get addicted persons into treatment. With our education and background, we have made a positive impact on many, many families in the past 6 years, just as the education and experience of PRC has made a positive impact on my life and the lives of many other families. Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Senators of the Committee, for your time and attention to this very serious matter, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you very much. Since we don't have time for the other three, we've already used up the time. So Maggie Penix, Fred Yates, and Brick Lentz, Dr. Brick Lentz, if you would submit your testimony in written form, we'll make sure that it gets on the record. And thank you very much, panel. With that, Laura Patton and Maura Roche, you have only about 2 minutes.
Against the clock.
I'll take a moment. But I let them have about 5 more minutes then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Maura Roach for Planned Parenthood. Again, we thank you for your time to hear this bill. I think that if there's one thing that we should all be able to agree about, it's that vulnerable women facing an unplanned pregnancy deserve the most support at the most critical time in their lives. Planned Parenthood has been dedicated to providing a full range of information in a non-judgmental, fully confidential setting for almost half a century in this state. We agree that CPCs have a right to operate in Oregon, but what Senate Bill 490 seeks to do is create some minimal standards about transparency of services provided in these entities and privacy of personal information which may be collected at intake. Many CPCs testified today that they keep personal information private, and we applaud those who do. In particular, we heard a lot from Lane County, which we which we've heard from before, and I think that they seem to make an argument for doing a number of things in the bill already, and I would hope that they would want all CPCs to operate in a similar manner that they do in terms of privacy of records or other information. And I think we need a bill like SB 490 in order to ensure that that is the standard that all of the CPC providers are operating at. And with that, I will conclude and thank the committee for your time.
All right. Committee. With that, thank you very much for being here. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 490 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 630.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 630 provides for licensing and regulation of anesthesiologist assistants. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
Okay.
You want to tell?
Yeah. Frank, is it Pam Rosen and Claire Chandler?
Yeah, she said there's an overflow, but we asked for them to come in first, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. Did we call their names again?
Okay. Is Frank, is it Pam Rosen? I can't.
Yeah.
And Claire Chandler?
Okay.
Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I am Dr. Frank Pomrose, the president of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists and the staff physician at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center.
Good afternoon. My name is Claire Chandler. I'm an anesthesiologist assistant practicing at Emory University in Georgia and also the current president of the National Association that represents the AA profession.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee. Again, I represent the physicians, anesthesiologists of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists, as well as my group, the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. Just get that wrong, Oregon Association of Anesthesiologists and the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. What I would like to do is give a brief description of an anesthesiology assistant and then answer questions you may have. An anesthesiology assistant is an individual who has received a pre-medical bachelor's degree with advanced training in chemistry, biology, and physics. They then take the MCAT, the Medical College Admission Test, or the graduate record exam, and apply to anesthesiology assistant programs, which are located east of here. There's 8 programs in the country. Once accepted, they received advanced training in anesthesia covering all aspects of this specialty. The training ranges from 24 to 28 months with up to 2,200 hours of clinical training. This leads to a master's level degree. An anesthesiology assistant must then be certified by the National Commission on the Certification of Anesthesiology Assistants, which is overseen by the National Board of Medical Examiners. To maintain certification, they must have 40 hours of CME every 2 years, and they recertify every 6 years. In clinical practice, an anesthesiologist assistant must be medically directed by an anesthesiologist in a ratio up to 4-1. Their practice is exclusively in the delivery of anesthesia, and they are not comparable to physician's assistants. They do not do clinical care outside of defined anesthesia privileges. Anesthesiology assistants and their society, the QAAA as we call it, the American Academy of Anesthesiology Assistants, are closely allied with the American Society of Anesthesiologists, with members on committees as well as joint committees on education and certification. I represent over 500 physicians anesthesiologists in Oregon, and I've been requested by several groups to promote anesthesiology assistants to be able to practice in this state, specifically the group in Bend, spearheaded by Chuck Anderson, and also with a group from Medford. My own particular group, the Oregon Anesthesiology Group, foresees that we will have a shortage of anesthesiologists in the next 5 to 6 years as the older group of us, me being one of them, phase out in the next 5 to 6 years. I've also seen reports that there may be a shortage of anesthesiologists that we could be able to draw to this state as well. Some states are reporting shortages of CRNAs, and so in order to stopgap and plug this thing and provide quality of care, we are asking for anesthesiologist assistants to be able to practice in the state. The goal is a triple aim: access, quality, and cost containment. And we just view anesthesiologist assistants as being able to partake in that system and to provide the issues that we need to have resolved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank you, Senator Anderson, and the committee for holding
this. And just restate your name.
Okay. Claire, for hosting this public event. I'm Claire Chandler. I am an anesthesiologist assistant representing the American Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants. Anesthesiologist assistants are defined by the Code of Federal Regulations as non-physician providers, and they're recognized by CMS and the VA system, similar to advanced practice nurses and physician assistants within the definition within the code. We help expand anesthesia services and increase access to patient care in a safe, truly multidisciplinary team model. And we also work with anesthesiologists and ensure that an anesthesiologist is involved in the care of every patient. With the upcoming implementation of the Affordable Care Act, steeply increasing aging population, and an increasing demand for anesthesia services, of which I'm sure everyone is aware, it's hard to predict exactly what the future of anesthesia needs will be. But it is a widely accepted concept that we need more healthcare providers. Non-physician providers are key to ensuring access to quality care in every discipline in a cost-effective manner. Currently, all other physician specialties may choose to work with an advanced practice nurse or a physician assistant. In fact, many physicians employ both in their practice. Anesthesiologists are the only physician specialty that does not have nationwide access to both provider types. SB 630 would eliminate this disparity in Oregon. Applicants, as Dr. Palmrose mentioned, 2AA programs are of the highest caliber. They have taken pre-med core curriculum courses to be eligible to apply, and the average GPA is over 3.0 for matriculants to AA programs. Currently, there are 1,500 practicing AAs across the country. We practice in 17 states plus the District of Columbia. We are producing about 200 AAs practitioners every year that are certified out of 8 education programs, and there are 2 programs in development. So I will say that it seems like we are a small non-physician provider profession. We are growing, and the interest in our profession is growing. We also receive many, many applicants for a handful of positions for these education programs. The programs are accredited by the Commission on Accreditation for Allied Health Education Programs, which also accredits over 20 allied health disciplines and more than 2,000 education programs across those disciplines. AAs, upon graduation, must sit for a certification examination that's administered by the National Commission for Certification of Anesthesiologist Assistants. And every 6 years, as mentioned, demonstrate continued qualifications by taking an examination and also continuing education requirements submitted every 2 years. Anesthesiologist assistants are unique anesthesia providers, and then we do work only under the care team model. And we do strongly believe that this is an excellent model of care for all citizens. And we work only under the direction of an anesthesiologist. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Is there any questions? Any discussion?
Thank you.
Comment? I do have some written material that we're submitting as well.
Wonderful. Okay. And do you have that written material?
Is that what we just passed out?
I think so.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Sean Dereem and Scott Rigdon.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, thank you for taking the time today to hear public testimony on Senate Bill 630. My name is Dr. Sean Dereemer, and I am the Executive Medical Director of Anesthesia Associates Northwest, located at 6400 Southeast Lake Road in Portland, Oregon. I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist residing and practicing in the state of Oregon. I'm here before you today in order to urge you to oppose Senate Bill 630. I believe this legislation is unnecessary, will increase the cost of anesthesia care to our patients, and is politically motivated by those opposed to CRNA practice. I'm adamantly opposed to this bill for the following reasons. The American Society of Anesthesiologists and the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists intend to supplant certified registered nurse anesthetists with lesser skilled providers, i.e. anesthesia assistants, who are clinically and financially dependent and under the direct control of anesthesiologists. As one may imagine, anesthesiologists are eager to maintain the relatively monopolistic position they have historically attempted to engender within the anesthesia market from a patient access and financial perspective. By establishing and promoting anesthesia assistants, they hope to undermine and or curtail independent CRNA practice in the marketplace. Endorsing Senate Bill 630 has significant implications relating to CRNA practice in Oregon. This legislation will increase the cost of anesthesia care to Oregonians, have a negative net impact on anesthesia access, and denigrate the anesthesia market with a redundancy of less qualified providers. Anesthesia assistants cannot practice independently and represent an unnecessary redundancy of providers caring for a single patient, thereby directly increasing cost. In other words, there's a net increase in cost to our healthcare system as a result of duplicity of anesthesia care. Because anesthesia assistants cannot practice without an anesthesiologist supervision, anesthesia assistants do not practice in rural areas where CRNAs are the primary independent providers of anesthesia care. Anesthesia assistants, in contrast, can only practice in conjunction with an anesthesiologist directly supervising them, which greatly limits their utilization. As such, anesthesia assistants are not a functional solution in helping solve considerations of inadequate access to anesthesia care in rural and underserved communities, while their clinical inflexibility prevents them from caring for patients in need of anesthesia intervention in off-site locations within our tertiary care medical centers. Anesthesiologists, in fact, report difficulties with supervision of anesthesia assistants. The Society of Anesthesiology reports that even appropriate ratios of anesthesiologists to anesthesia assistants would result in lapses of supervision during critical portions of anesthetic cases. In a review of one-year data from a tertiary care hospital, lapses occurred commonly during first case starts, even with a 1-to-2 supervisory ratio. To date, there are no peer review studies in scientific journals relating to the quality of care of anesthesia outcomes on behalf of anesthesia assistants. Anesthesia assistants are explicitly recognized in 13 states and the District of Columbia. In fact, Louisiana has recently passed legislation that has effectively prohibited anesthesia assistant practice, declaring, and I quote, CRNAs receive a much higher level of education and training than do anesthesia assistants. Now, while the U.S. Department of Education does not recognize anesthesia assistants accreditation entity, it's important to note that CRNA education surpasses that of anesthesia assistants by as much as a year, all after having already received a bachelor's in nursing degree and obtaining multiple years of critical care nursing experience prior to the application or, in fact, enrollment process in accredited CRNA training programs. That degree yields a minimum of a master's degree, and in most CRNA training programs, are actually moving towards a doctorate in nurse anesthesia. Senate Bill 630 encourages a monopolistic marketplace whereby more cost-efficient providers, i.e. CRNAs, would be significantly disadvantaged and in jeopardy of being replaced by lesser-skilled providers who legally are unable to practice independently. Finally, many U.S. states have turned away from anesthesia assistants by virtue of their lack of health care experience, abbreviated training, limited scope of practice, increased costs, and inability to improve patient access across service lines and geographic regions. For the aforementioned reasons, this iteration of provider is not a viable option for our nation's future anesthesia needs, but rather an ASA initiative driven by a desire to control and intent to supplant over a century of vetted, high-quality care rendered by our CRNA colleagues. A valuable anesthesia resource that is neither in short supply nor lacking in willingness to serve our communities in a cost-conscious fashion. In fact, our collaborative care team model, CRNA-MD anesthesia model, can be delivered to this marketplace at 65% of the cost of our MD anesthesia-only practices while substantially improving access, efficiency, and customer service across all communities and service lines. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that as a board-certified anesthesiologist, I have worked collaboratively with my CRNA colleagues for over 17 years and under some of the most demanding circumstances the industry has to offer. Our team approach to complex clinical scenarios has continued to exceed the expectations of our patients while yielding quality outcomes that are undisputed in the literature. I implore you to thoroughly consider the impact this potential legislation will have on the practice of our CRNA colleagues who have expertly provided high-quality, cost-effective anesthesia care to our state for more than 100 years. Please carefully consider the impact of this bill on the cost, access, and quality of health care in our state. Again, I thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Scott Rigdon, and I am a nurse anesthetist and the current president of the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists. Thank you for the opportunity. ARANA has represented the safety of citizens in Oregon and CRNA practice interests for more than 78 years, and we stand in firm opposition of Senate Bill 630. Overall, this proposed bill has the potential to significantly and negatively impact the quality of anesthesia care in our state and increase the risk of negative health outcomes for the citizens of Oregon. ARANA has many significant concerns related to Senate Bill 630. For brevity, I will highlight our most important concerns. First, as you heard earlier, the proponents of this bill detailed nicely the educational criteria that is required to become an anesthesiology assistant. I wanted you to keep a few important things in mind. CRNAs have a master's or doctoral degree upon completing their training. AAs have a master's degree upon completing their training. This is the only weak similarity between us. To date, there is no peer-reviewed patient safety data or outcome data published in any peer-reviewed journal. There are estimated to be around 1,500 AAs in the United States. There are over 40,000 CRNAs and over 35,000 anesthesiologists. Upon entering training, CRNAs have substantial direct care patient experiences and nursing training, nurse anesthesia programs average 30 months nationally. AAs are not required to have direct patient care experience prior to starting their training, and the entire AA program is 24 months. Earlier we heard that there's the potential for having a shortage of anesthesia providers in our state. Currently, after a review this last week of all jobs posted for CRNAs in the state, there were three. Of those postings, phone calls were made to all three, of those groups, and the only jobs that are currently available are already filled. Posting the job is only a formality required by the facility. Each CRNA job in the state averages 10 to 15 applicants that are more than qualified per position. That's from oral communication. And personally, in our group, an independent CRNA group of over 9 CRNAs, as we had to add another to our group last year, we had over 40 applicants in 5 days that were more than qualified to join our group. So currently, there is no workforce shortage for anesthesia in the state from a CRNA side of things. Under Oregon state law, CRNAs practice in collaboration with anesthesiologists or without. Therefore, the concept of supervision for CRNAs is a billing concept, not a clinical function. And I'll make reference to that shortly with respect to one of the studies that's contained in your handout that you received. This means that CRNAs can practice to the full extent of their education and training. In Oregon, patients who require the skill of a highly trained anesthesia professional may either have those services provided by a physician anesthesiologist or a nurse anesthetist. This may occur in a variety of staffing models based on the needs and culture of a particular facility or group. Specifically, Senate Bill 630 allows for a very minor and very poorly understood anesthesia provider type to begin functioning in our state. By training and proposed law, an AA is not an independent clinician, and when a clinical scenario arises which needs to be addressed immediately through rapid assessment and intervention, the individual who is presumed to be at the bedside may be tied up with 3 other patients that they could be responsible for under Senate Bill 630. Where is the individual Oregonian left in this scenario? Furthermore, a very well-designed study in 2012 published in Anesthesiology, the monthly journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, highlights the risk of lack of supervision in a much greater detail. And a lack of supervision in this case means anesthesiologist availability. on this copy, if you were to refer to page 683 at the top in the right-hand corner, there's a little blue box, and it says what this article tells us that is new. What this article tells us is that lapses in supervision occurred commonly during the first case starts, even with 1-to-2 supervision ratio. In addition, when staffing ratios decrease from 1-to-2 to 1-to-3, the average frequency of lack of supervision went from 13.9% to 61.9% of the cases. And if one follows the extrapolated data on the last page of this article, one can see that when the supervision ratio goes to 1-to-4, which is what is proposed in Senate Bill 630, it is nearly impossible for supervision to take place during these cases due to anesthesia workflow and demands of those who are involved. And that's right here. So, in addition, I would also like to highlight, a reasonable person may conclude that Oregonians will be placed at significant risk based on this research by the passage of Senate Bill 630. Recent evidence on the reality of supervision. Just this last month, a $1.2 million whistleblower case highlights the concept and clinical reality of supervision in anesthesia practice. I am summarizing what was published based on this case. And it is as follows. The California Board of Regents agreed to a $1.2 million settlement to resolve allegations of submitting claims which involved insufficient supervision of CRNAs and anesthesiology residents, which violates Medicare and Medicaid policy as well as the Federal False Claims Act. According to the plaintiff, anesthesiologist presence was commonly documented and billed for while charts were retrospectively signed and the anesthesiologists were not available for supervision or at times not physically present in the same building as the procedure. There are other legal and financial ramifications that are coming out from this recent case that are still pending. And in Oregon, the concept of supervision does not apply because we are an opt-out state, which means, depending on the facility or culture, we function independently without the supervision of anesthesiologists if that is how it is decided to go in that facility. While IRANA has identified numerous portions of Senate Bill 630 which decrease patient safety, with vague language, clauses which allow for significant room for lack of supervision, and provisions that specifically allow for individuals who are not certified to gain licensure, I would specifically like to name a few of those. One is a temporary license provision which allows for AAs to receive temporary licensure until they pass their certifying exam. And there's also a non-certified licensure provision which allows an individual who has not met the certification requirements to gain licensure. In addition, the word supervision throughout the bill is not clearly defined, and there's no concise definition of what supervision of an AA constitutes. In summary, Orana stands in opposition to Senate Bill 630 out of a deep professional concern for the safety of the citizens of Oregon. There is no substitute for the education and training CRNAs receive prior to entering the healthcare marketplace. When I think of the average reasonable Oregonian seeking anesthesia services at facilities I work at, I am compelled to invoke the reasonable person standard related to the perception of how anesthesia care is delivered and how they would react if full disclosure was actually relayed as to who will be at the head of the table. And in this scenario, I'd like to just give two examples. This is my everyday thing when I... I would like to convey my usual introduction when I walk into the room in the morning. It goes a little bit like this. Hello, my name is Scott Rigdon. I'm a nurse anesthetist. I'll be keeping you safe during your surgical procedure today. From now until I deliver you to the highly specialized nurses in the PACU, I will be at the head of the table the entire case and personally performing all aspects of your anesthesia care while you're in the operating room. Do you have any questions before I ask you a few questions? And scenario two, under what Senate Bill 630 may allow. Hello, my name is Bill. I'm an anesthesiology assistant, and I will be working under the supervision of Dr. X. We will collaborate to keep you safe while you're in the operating room today. Dr. X will be present during the important portions of the case, and I will be present the entire case. If a serious situation should arise and Dr. X is busy with the other three patients under his or her supervision today, then he or she should be immediately available to quickly assess and intervene. After the case is over, Dr. X will be solely responsible for your care in the postoperative period, unless he or she is involved with the other three patients under his or her care. Do you have any questions before I ask you questions? This is the reality of what Senate Bill 630 proposes. And as I said earlier, Orana is adamantly against this. In closing, I would like to convey an important clinical concept that I try to impart on all of the nurse anesthesia trainees who work their ways through the facilities in which I practice. I absolutely expect that they will gain the necessary knowledge, clinical skills, and anesthesia prowess to take care of my wife, children, and close family. I tell each and every one of them that our profession demands, and I expect that that I am ever involved in an event which lands me or my loved ones in their care, I expect nothing but the best, no matter how they choose to practice, in collaboration or independently. Ultimately, they are responsible for the welfare of any patient that comes under their care. Nothing else matters. If you need more training in a specific area, get it. If you discover a knowledge deficit, fix it. The profession of nurse anesthesia is strong and relevant in healthcare transformation today because CRNAs always keep the patient first. Thank you for your time, and I respectfully request that Senate Bill 630 be dismissed and the committee consider taking up a bill which limits the addition of any new healthcare provider into Oregon until either a workforce and or a workforce study is established and a workforce need is established and peer-reviewed patient safety data is published. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No discussion? Thank you very much, panel. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 630 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 717.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 717 requires specified healthcare professional training programs to include in the required curricula training on standardized clinical breast examinations, requires that the programs annually report the implementation progress to the Oregon Health Authority, requires the authority to compile the information and report that to the Legislative Assembly by December 31st of each year. Sunsets on the convening date in 2018. This has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Okay. Senator Steiner Hayward, and I think Diane Pulser, are you on the phone?
I didn't hear anybody.
No. And then Dr. Michelle Berlin. You can come up.
They're calling in now?
They are? Okay. Well, we're on. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator representing District 17, Northwest Portland, Unincorporated Washington County. I am also, in my other life, a family physician on faculty at Oregon Health and Science University and director of the Knight Cancer Institute Breast Health Education Program. Senate Bill 717 comes to you in response to Senate Bill 493 in the 2011 session, which my predecessor, Senator Bonham, now Congresswoman Bonamici, brought forward at the encouragement and instigation, in a positive sense of that term, from her, now my constituent, Diane Pulser, from whom you'll be hearing shortly. Ms. Pulser will tell you of her experience with a delay of diagnosis of breast cancer and how it motivated her to bring to our attention some of the concerns about health provider education, about appropriate breast exam techniques, and management of abnormal findings. This is an area that I have been closely involved with professionally since 2001, and so then-Senator Bonamici asked me to assist her and Ms. Pulser in developing this legislation, which I believe came before this committee in 2011, if I'm correct, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 493 required the establishment of a task force to evaluate, first and foremost, ways to improve clinical breast exam training in Oregon for those healthcare professionals who typically perform these exams as part of improving early detection of breast cancer. I had the privilege of serving as the chair of this work group. Ms. Pulser was on that. We had a really wonderful group of committed professionals of all sorts. We have oncologists and internists and nurse practitioners and public health professionals. And it was a great group of people who worked very, very hard. We had able assistance from the health authority via health authority and the breast and cervical cancer program. And I'm very, very grateful to them and to, in particular, Katie King for her able assistance in helping us with the committee and the task force and with writing up our report, which I believe we have submitted separately, but if not, we will. Ultimately, after much discussion about what would be the best way to put this to advance the cause of educating healthcare professionals well, the task force came up with a recommendation that you see before you. I will say that I had a really tough time figuring out the best path for this task force because I have struggled with this problem for well over a decade now. We are stuck between a rock and a hard place when it comes to improving early detection of breast cancer. We are doing no better now in Oregon than we were in 2001, essentially. We have not improved the rate of early detection. Mammography has its limitations, as I think members of this committee are all too aware. In fact, you heard earlier this year about the challenges with women with dense breast tissue, and that's a big problem. Clinical breast exam, we believe to be effective when done properly, but we have no great data to support that. Mandating education is something that, as you well know, I have historically had problems with, and I am supportive of this proposal, and I still think in general it's a good idea, but I do think we have to be very careful. I think more than anything we need to educate our health professional training programs about the need for consistent training in this really critically important physical exam technique, that we cannot do the standard, what some of the women's health magazines called as early as 2005, the annual pat-down that many women experience. We know that that's what too many of us, and frankly, myself included, although now I have a family doctor who I trained, and she does very good breast exams, but I think many women who've been through an annual exam can testify to the fact that they have not have received at best a cursory physical exam of their breasts. And for most women, that's an important part of early detection of breast cancer. So in summary, I want to be sure to allow Ms. Pulser, who was an instrumental part of bringing Senate Bill 493 forward and part of the task force that was created by 493, and Dr. Michelle Berlin, who's co-director of the Center for Women's Health at Oregon's Health and Science University, to testify. So if I may, I'm going to close here, Madam Chair, and I'll remain here in case you all have any questions after their testimony.
Great.
Thank you.
Diane Pulser, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Diane Holzer, and I regret not being able to be before you today. I had hoped to travel down to Salem, but my 9-year-old daughter is at home today with a fever and pneumonia, so I'm sorry not to be there. I'm the mother of 2 daughters, a wife, and a breast cancer survivor. This summer will be 5 years after my diagnosis, and I'm testifying before you today to urge you to pass Senate Bill 717, which I think will save lives. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, and I want to thank Senator Steiner, Senator Moniz Anderson, and former Senator Bonamici, who helped pass Senate Bill 493, which is what established the Oregon Task Force on Breast Cancer, of which I was a part of. So just very briefly, my story is that I went to my internist in 2007, and frankly, a proper clinical breast exam probably, we'll never know for sure, but I pointed out a lump to my internist in 2007. He did a very cursory, as Senator Steiner just testified, kind of a tap and go, and told me not to worry about it. It was a rip. Of course, even though I'm an educated woman, I wanted to believe him and did. A year later, in 2008, summer of 2008, I went to my gynecologist for a routine exam. She found the same lump after doing a clinical breast exam of about 3 minutes, which I now know to be the standard of care. And she said, "You have a lump." And I said, "No, I don't. I have a rib." And we went back and forth for a while, and she sent me off to imaging and a breast biopsy. The next day I learned I had breast cancer, and frankly, then I knew I had breast cancer for a year that went untreated. 5 days later, I had a double mastectomy. And since at the time I had a 4-year-old and 14-year-old daughter, I opted for aggressive treatment, which included 10 rounds of chemotherapy, as I said, a bilateral mastectomy, and radiation. Query whether, the lump that was much smaller the year before, whether I could have had less aggressive treatment. We'll never know that. So soon after I finished my treatment, about 4 years ago, Dr. Maureen Filipek came to me, who was the doctor who performed my breast biopsy, and she said to me, "I have seen 35 women in the last year that weren't diagnosed after telling their doctor they had a lump." So she's a radiologist. She said that they told her that their internist or their family practice doctor or their, whoever told them they were too young to have cancer, it was nothing. Either they performed a cursory exam and they never found it. So anyway, she came to me, Dr. Filipek, and she said, "Could you help me? I know you're a lawyer," so I'm a lawyer. And so I went to Suzanne Bonamici, who's now in the U.S. Congress because I went to law school with Senator Bonamici, and we enlisted Senator Steiner and Tony Mountain from Komen, who I think also testified via letter today, to look at drafting Senate Bill 493. So that happened 2 years ago, which established the task force. Senator Steiner was the chair of the Oregon Breast Cancer Task Force over about the last, 9 months. So we met 3 or 4 times, and we came up with Senate Bill 717, which mandates proper clinical breast exams for medical students, physician's assistants, nurses, residents, healthcare providers. So it mandates training for appropriate clinical breast exams. This is a step to help improve the outcome for other women by educating health providers, care providers in training, logically makes a difference. And hopefully you will agree with Senator Steiner and I that it's a first step and a good step and not too aggressive in terms of telling all doctors, here's what you must do, but just having them be trained appropriately when they start out from the get-go. And hopefully it will allow earlier diagnosis of breast cancer and save lives. So thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you, and congratulations on being 5 years.
Thank you.
Questions? All right, Dr. Michelle Berlin, are you on the line?
I am on the line. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm Michelle Berlin. I am an OBGYN and preventive medicine trained specialist, and I am, as Senator Hayward mentioned, co-director of the Center for Women's Health, and I'm vice chair of the Department of OBGYN. And as it happens, clinical breast exams have been a particular interest of mine for a very long time, and I have been teaching this particular technique for, I realized the other day, probably about 20 years, which seems like quite a long time. And it's frustrating that this is not still the standard exam that most people use. It's true that there have been some studies that have been done with it. They are rather limited. When you look at what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends, they last came out with an opinion about this in 2007. And as you all know, this is the body that helps to decide what should be thought about by clinicians across the country when they're doing particular types of clinical exams. And at that point, they said they could neither say that it was a good thing or a bad thing. Their actual recommendation was that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the additional benefits and harms of a clinical breast exam beyond screening mammography. It turns out the Canadians have looked at this a little bit more recently, and they feel a bit more strongly about it. And I think that the reason that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force said what it did, that the studies they looked at a whole bunch of different kinds of exam techniques, not just this particular one. And having trained a lot of medical students and a lot of residents over the years, I am absolutely convinced that this is the best type of exam. I wish that it was as well studied as other things are in clinical medicine and we had good data for it. We have some. But I think particularly in women who are in younger age groups, 40 to 49, where we know that mammograms may not work as well, clinical breast exam is really are the mainstay of clinical care. And there are many, many stories, just as the person testified before me has, of things that have been missed or not well taken care of. The standard recommendations are, if a patient finds something, even if the provider doesn't, they should have it evaluated further. So I apologize on behalf of my clinician colleagues who didn't follow the standard recommendations for this. The exam itself is really pretty simple to teach. It takes, as any other type of clinical exam, it takes a while to learn it. You have to be monitored to make sure that you're doing it right, but it is pretty easily taught in good circumstances. One of the things I can tell you that many clinicians are concerned about is that this particular technique takes longer than other techniques, and that's true. And I believe it's because it's particularly thorough and particularly systematic in how it's applied. And I know there's been a hue and cry among the public in general and certainly among some of my colleagues about, gee, we're not doing pap smears quite as often. That's a whole different discussion. We could have another point if you want. But I think at that point, the comment about there not being enough time and a visit starts to be less of an issue. Generally, in clinical care, very often we're given a 15-minute visit to do a return and well woman exam. If we're not doing a pap smear or a pelvic exam if not needed, then that saves a fair bit of time, and I think one can put that time to better use in doing a very careful clinical breast exam using this particular technique. So I think this technique is the one to teach. I've been teaching it a long time. I look forward to helping other people learn about it. And I think if we see this as the primary standard technique going forward, that's really the best of all possible outcomes. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you today.
And thank you so much for your testimony. Is there discussion? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Steiner Hayward or whoever, I guess. Well, any of the three.
I know.
Okay. I don't know who's best to answer this question. You're all three involved. I understand that. I'm curious on a couple points in the bill. Number one, it sunsets and goes away, so I'm assuming you're assuming that it becomes standard at that point, but I find it interesting. I mean, we just heard testimony that this is a really good method, okay? But the language in the bill is specific to just that method and not, I mean, should it be, I would wonder if we have language including but not limited to, in case, you know, science changes over time. And so I guess that's my question is why are we so narrow here and not including that in maybe, Doc, you know this stuff better than I do. I'm just kind of looking at the language and wondering why we are so point specific on this.
Dr. Berlin, would you like to take that one, or would you like me to?
I can start, and then you can pick it up. I understand why you're saying that, and I think it's a valid concern. And I think if were I working on the bill myself, it would make sense to add a comment that says if a better technique is determined in the future, to think about using that instead. I can tell you that over the last 25 years that I've been in clinical practice, there has not been any other exam developed that is as good as this one. If there is one, I think that would be phenomenal to have it come forward, but currently we don't know of one. That said, I agree to have something that says if another type of exam that is well vetted and evidence-based is found, that would make sense.
Okay. It may just be a matter of adding some language, including but not limited to. It just.
Yeah, if I may, Madam Chair, add on to what Dr. Berlin said. I appreciate Senator Cruz's concern, and I am as concerned as he about specifying a specific physical exam technique in statute. That being said, I would point out what Dr. Berlin testified to, which is the concern that this method does take a lot more time. And this turns out to be one of those things where people don't think they need to learn it until they learn it, and then they become, you know, sort of like ex-smokers. They're passionate about it. Yes, that was a pointed comment, Senator Cruz. I think that my concern is that if we put in language such as including but not limited to, it might give an awful lot of wiggle room. I'd certainly be willing, and as I'm sure the others would be, to consider alternate language that reflected Dr. Berlin's point about if another technique comes along that's evidence-based and clearly shows more efficacy, you know, it's both more sensitive and more specific, to use the medical terms, i.e. it's more likely to pick up a problem and not give you a false positive finding, then if we could find a way to craft that language, I'd be perfectly willing to consider it. But the including but not limited to in this particular instance, I think is problematic.
Okay. You know, Madam Chair, I'm probably not as concerned about putting something specific in statute, because this does sunset and goes away in 2018. So it will no longer be in statute at that point in time, correct?
Yes, we're hoping it won't be needed by then.
Well, I understand that. So it's not like we're putting something we're going to have to necessarily go back. Like I said, this is not my field, mm-hmm. obviously. Ask me about carrots, I can tell you, but this I don't, so.
Well, my main concern is because, you know, we're all into evidence-based, and as I think Dr. Berlin said, it's not well studied. There's some data, but it's more anecdotal, and to put that in statute, especially in the medical field where things are changing so fast, but if we save a life, we catch breast cancer. I mean, you know, it's a catch 22.
Yeah, I, Madam Chair, I really appreciate that concern. I think all of us on the task force, as well as Dr. Berlin, do. We're in a sort of catch 22 situation here. To really study this technique well, we would have to do probably a 10-year randomized controlled trial with about 10,000 women, probably requiring that some of them not get mammograms, and that really wouldn't be standard of care at this point, and that kind of a study is impossible to do in the United States or really any developed country at this point. It would be unethical, even though mammography itself has its challenges as a screening technique. So we may be in a position where we will never have good data to support this. All we know is the data that we do have, some of which is from my own research, is relatively clear that this technique is better than the existing techniques. We just don't have great data to show whether it actually improves morbidity and mortality from breast cancer.
When I first met you, you had Dr. Bates and I up in your office back in the early 2000s, to them, where you actually showed us how to do this technique. So I know it is a passion for you, and I know that you know a whole lot about this. Any other comments? All right, thank you who are on the phone. I think one of you anyway is going to stay on for the next bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 717 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222 directs the Oregon Health Authority to conduct a study assessing the activities relating to the human papillomavirus and to prepare the human papillomavirus and related cancer comprehensive control plan. This has a January 2nd, 2015 sunset date. It has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Okay, Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Girod.
Thank you. I'll probably be the briefest. Chair Mona Anderson and colleagues, Senator Fred Girod, I represent District 9, rural parts of Clackamas, Marion, and Linn counties. I'm here to speak about the emerging public health emergency, and that is the HPV virus. As most of you know, I'm a dentist. My profession, along with the medical community, is just beginning to fully realize the link between the group of viruses and many forms of cancer. Let's talk numbers. The HPV rates, according to CDC, 21,000 cancers are due to HPV virus. And surprisingly, 12,000 of those are in men, 9,000 are in women. Approximately 79 million Americans are currently infected with the HPV virus, and about 14 million will become newly infected each year. The HPV risk, according to CDC, is so common that nearly all sexually active men and women get at least one type of this virus at some point in their life. We need to do something. So the senator to my right here and I got together and we started talking about the possibility of immunizations, but that's a pretty big step. And so this is the reason for the bill, is just to state that we have a real problem here and we need to do something about it, and we're looking for solutions. And so I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you so much, Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, and my good colleague, Senator Girod. I'm a family physician, so you've got two healthcare professionals sitting in front of you talking about what I would agree is a public health emergency and really a lack of public education about this. And the core intent of this bill is to have the health authority do what it does best, which is understand how this condition is affecting Oregonians and how best we can educate Oregonians so they can make informed choices about helping themselves avoid infection, either through appropriate prevention or through immunization or both, and to really help families make appropriate decisions about this. One of the examples is that most people don't know, for example, that now that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend this immunization for boys as well as girls, and it used to be just for girls. Whether immunization is the only path towards managing this problem, I'm not sure I could tell you, and that's one of the things we hope to determine. It's certainly an important step. We know that there are immunizations available that address the four most common types of HPV and two of the ones that are most likely to cause the cancers that Senator Girod referred to. And we should point out that these cancers affect all parts of the body. They're oral cancers, which is where his interest comes from, and mine as well. There are cervical cancers, and I believe Dr. Berlin will testify more about those. Anal, penile cancers, the range is skin cancers. There are a huge range of cancers that are caused by these strains of this human papillomavirus. It's very important for Oregonians to be educated about these viruses and the impact that they can have on their health, and that's what we're asking the health authority to do, and we look forward to answering any questions after Dr. Berlin's testimony.
Okay. Let's hear Dr. Berlin's testimony, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Dr. Berlin?
Hello. Thank you again for inviting me to be able to speak about the importance of HPV vaccine and HPV overall. So, in fact, this is my particular research
and
area.
For the record, state your name for the record again.
Oh, I'm sorry. Michelle Berlin, Vice Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Co-Director of the OHSU Center for Women's Health. HPV, as you've heard about, is an enormous problem both internationally and in the United States. It's the leading cause of cancer-related death in developing countries, and you've heard how many new cases we see in the United States. Oregon is no exception. The way I think about this is the numbers break out such that there are about 3 women diagnosed with cervical cancer each week, and one of them dies of it. So this is not a simple problem, and I find it quite honestly
very problematic that in our state and our country that any woman dies of cervical cancer. If it's caught early, it can be absolutely taken care of pretty simply. So that's really a problem. So what do we need to do? Well, we know that there are two parts of what can be done to do this, take care of this. One of them, of course, is Pap screening, and as you all know, that's one of the public health successes of the last century. But people aren't getting Pap smears as much as they should. So in the between 2004 and 2010, our rates in Oregon dropped 8 percentage points from about 86% to about 79%. Now, the goal that the federal government has set is 93%, so we are nowhere near that. I will tell you that most states aren't near it, but just to show you that it's really a problem. So Pap smears can help us detect cervical cancer early. It can, a variant of a Pap test can also be used to help screen in the throat, in the anal area as well, and there's certainly movement to do both of those things more often. So that's how we can help detect things once they're there. How can we help prevent that this happen at all? Well, as you've heard from other folks giving testimony today, HPV is exceedingly common. 80% of women age 50 and over have it. So, in fact, the question might be, how come there aren't more cancers rather than how come there are the ones that there are? The thing that we do know that really can make a difference is the vaccine. And as Senator Hayward pointed out, it is now approved for both boys and girls. Very effective, extraordinarily safe. But I think it's very true that the general public just doesn't realize how much of a problem this can be. I think in some ways some of our youngsters know better than their parents do a little bit in some cases, but I think there's plenty more that needs to be done to help make sure that everyone knows what they need to about this. So I thank you for giving me the chance to provide this testimony.
Thank you very much. And Dan Jarman can come on up. And Senator Cruz, what
would you think? Yeah, I support this. I'm obviously a strong advocate for early detection. And some things are easier to detect than others. So, Dan.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman representing Providence Health and Services and specifically today Providence Cancer Center. Providence Cancer Center offers the latest in cancer services, including diagnostic, evidence-based treatments, programs, prevention, education, support, and internationally renowned research. We're very delighted to support this bill. When we sent this bill to our content experts at Providence Cancer Center, they were just delighted that there's going to be an effort to look into this and not just educate the public, but look at something that can be in a plan that can come to the legislature as we raise awareness of this issue. So I wanted to thank Senator Hayward, Representative Girard, Senator Bates for bringing this bill.
And it's Senator Girard.
I'm sorry, Senator Girard. I apologize. It's late. It's been a long hearing. Right? I've demoted you. I apologize. We look forward to.
Just stay on this side.
Yeah.
Right. No longer welcome on the other side.
I know. We look forward to working with you in this committee, working on this agency. The Providence Cancer Front of folks would very much like to be involved in this effort, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, I do see that, you know, we're asking the health authority to assess, and it doesn't have a ways and means referral on it, but it sort of would be nice to have Dr. Katrina Hedberg come up and at least give us your take on it without really...
Unofficially.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division of the Health Authority. And as has already been mentioned, obviously, we're very much in favor of doing what we can to address the issue of HPV-related cancer. Worldwide, it is the leading cause of cervical cancer in women, but that's in the United States. We also have a fair amount of cervical cancer as well as oral cancers, anal cancers, penile cancers in men, et cetera. So figuring out how to address it is really important. We do, at the Public Health Division, we have funding from the Centers for Disease Control to do address a number of cancer-related issues. We have a comprehensive cancer control plan. And actually, one of the proposed amendments to this current bill is that we will do an amendment to this, or an addition, if you will, to our comprehensive cancer control plan that we have funding for to, in fact, collect data and address these issues of HPV. So that would take care of some of the fiscal that you're mentioning about, is that we do specifically, again, have funding for this.
And everybody's in agreement with the dash ones then?
We're all happy.
Okay. So this could just go to the floor.
Well, yeah. we'll need a fiscal.
Right. We'll need a fiscal. But yes,
go ahead. Yes, members of the committee, thank you. Yes, so we'd be happy to do an analysis very specifically of that to address. But again, we're committed. And as been mentioned, we need both public awareness about increasing the uptake, if you will, of HPV vaccination, not only in young women who it was first recommended for, but now boys as well as girls, and educate providers and parents to increase the uptake, to understand what the impact of that is. And in fact, we do surveillance for now cervical dysplasia, not only cervical cancer, so we can see whether or not that's decreasing. And folks already had addressed the issue of decreasing pap smears. In fact, if you're decreasing the amount of HPV, you may not need as many pap smears. But again, we're committed to learning more about this very important topic.
All right.
Thank you. Chair, like I said, I support this. Let's just find out where we need to send it, and then we can send it to the appropriate place. So.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much, panel. No further people. All right. No more discussion. Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722, and we are adjourned.